My name is Charlie Mays, and the title of this morning's Bible study is The Cross is the Foolishness of God. And what I will attempt to do in the time we have is to do a survey that suggests that the cross is the measure of both the scriptural witness and the church's witness to who God is. It will be somewhat sketchy, I'm afraid, and we will jump around a lot in the Bible, and I'm going to leave an awful lot of connections for you to make. And I don't, in one sense, apologize for that, but hopefully it will be provocative enough so that you will want to engage in the discussion. Just a word about who I am. Several have asked that, I guess including my mother, but I am a parish pastor. I serve a congregation of the American Lutheran Church in Renton, Washington, which is demographically a contiguous suburb to Seattle, but has its own kind of identity and uniqueness. I started that congregation 8 years ago, and I'm on a leave to be here this summer to be the program director here in the village. So I bring not an academic background to this discussion, but a pastoral background to it, so that hopefully that will give you some understanding about the kinds of issues I'm struggling with. I would like to begin, as I begin most of my sessions, with a little kind of a word of poetry, and this comes from one of the two theme books this summer, entitled Elements of Hope by James Carroll. And this little thing is entitled, The Thing Is Not to Ask God Too Many Questions. The thing is not to ask God too many questions because he is dumb. He does not answer. He waits till things are simpler. Next year, perhaps, there will be an answer. The thing is not to think of God as a nice fellow, because take it from me, he is tough. If you let him, he will scorch your hair with fire. He will drown you nearly naked with his water. The air of his breath can be just awful, and he will surely bury you with earth. Hope is a matter of lowered expectations. It is when the great marble statue topples of the comforting God who tucks you in his safest pocket, of the magic mystery who always makes things better. When it topples, though you flee on your head, it is then that the real God of Job's old fight stands up glaring. What else is there to say from the pile of ruined expectations but hope is not what I thought it was, or even though you slay me, and he will, I will trust you. Which is another way of saying, my God, you must be kidding. Hope like that is hard, especially for narcissists like us. The thing is not to take God too seriously, because by our standards, God is slightly crazy. Here is hope. By his standards, we are slightly crazy too. And that is what you and I and God have in common, common craziness. Theologians call it grace. Let us pray. Give us grace, O God, that our eyes might be opened to see you in the cross of Jesus Christ and in all the crosses from the beginning to the end of time, and that in seeing you in the cross we see your very heart and we see your pain and we see your love. Amen. I'd like to start with a quote from Jürgen Moltmann's book, The Crucified God. And I have listed a whole bunch of books that I will make some reference to many of them during the time this morning. The book that I would most recommend, in fact, I had Mary put out the copies that were in the bookstore on that butcher block display table that's in the bookstore. It's called Crucifixion by Martin Hengel. And it gives you some background about the world in which the message of the crucified God was first proclaimed. And it's only 98 pages with all of the indexes. So it's not a very long book, but and it's also a book which you should read on a day when everything is going right, because it's very depressing. I mean, when it outlines what crucifixion really is, that's a downer. And then three books by Doug Hall, Douglas John Hall, Light in Our Darkness, then The Reality of the Gospel and the Unreality of the Churches, and I'll use a quote from Has the Church a Future? Then Shizuko Endo, who is a Japanese Roman Catholic lay person, a novelist, listed one of his books, which is also in the bookstore, called Silence. That's just an absolutely beautiful, beautiful novel. He has another book, I think, that's also in the bookstore called The Life of A Life of Jesus. Endo's agenda in life is to try to struggle with why the Japanese have not become Christian, given the fact that Christian missionaries have been there since the Jesuits came in the 1500s, but they never took a hold, they never got a grasp in Japan. He struggles with why. Interesting answer, he suggests. Jesus Means Freedom by Ernst Käsemann. Käsemann's commentary on Romans, which I think is absolutely the best New Testament commentary on anything. And then the interpretation article from April 1971, which has the whole issue is devoted to a paper and some responses that the Lutheran Church in Germany did, entitled Understanding the Meaning of the Death of Jesus. And Käsemann has an article on the Pauline theology of the cross in that. And then Where God Meets Man, a little book of theology intended for laity by Gerhard Ferdi, Where God Meets Man, Luther's Down-to-Earth Approach to the Gospel. I'll also use some of that. I'm going to read a little bit in a moment from The Crucified God by Jürgen Moltmann. And then Paul Among Jews and Gentiles will be a major source for something I want to talk about in just a moment. This is what Moltmann says about the theology of the cross, about understanding that if you're going to understand God, you've got to start with the cross. The final issue, however, is that of the radical orientation of theology and the church on Christ, Jesus died crying out to God, "My God, why hast thou forsaken me?" All Christian theology and all Christian life is basically an answer to the question which Jesus asked as he died. The atheism of protests and of metaphysical rebellions against God are also answers to this question. Either Jesus, who was abandoned by God, is the end of all theology, or he is the beginning of a specifically Christian and therefore critical and liberating theology and life. And that's what I want to suggest, is that Jesus is the beginning of the specifically Christian theology, although in another sense he is only the amplification of a theology that I see beginning right away in the Old Testament. If you have Bibles, and if you don't, there are some back on the shelf back there just on this side of the entranceway, and I really recommend you have a Bible, because we're going to be doing Bible study and spending our time in the Bible, and so it'll be helpful to you to have a Bible access. I want to look at this passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 17 and following. Jürgen Moltmann says that it's very, very hard to recall a God who suffers in the midst of an officially optimistic society that is at the moment knee-deep in blood. That for us who are North Americans and North Europeans who have it pretty well, it's very hard for us to get into this understanding of God, particularly when much of the way we live is a problem to the rest of the world. And so when you're living among the top 6% of all the dogs, it's very hard to understand what it's like underneath. Okay? And that the God that we have to deal with is the one who tends to stand with the folks underneath. And I'm going to try to demonstrate that. All right? Looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 17 and following. I'm going to go to the end of the chapter, so you'll know how much I'm going to read. "For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, and not with eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God, for it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart. Where is the wise person? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For consider your call, brethren. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. He is the source of your life in Christ Jesus, whom God made our wisdom and our righteousness and sanctification and redemption. Therefore it is written, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. Now you maybe notice a word that Paul has repeated here several times, folly. And Hengel, in his opening pages, suggests that one of the important things for us to get a hold of is what that word folly means. It doesn't mean just some kind of intellectual defect. In fact, he says when Jerome translates it into the Latin, he probably catches the meaning of folly that the Greek word has better than anything when he calls it mania or madness. It is unthinkable madness that Paul is suggesting as the methodology for God's work in the cross. Now, the thing that Hengel does, and I won't go into this, he shows that in every culture to which the gospel was proclaimed in its day, crucifixion was despicable, and that none of the heroes ever died by crucifixion. And that by the time you get to the Roman Empire, crucifixion is a form of death save for slaves and the lowest class of people, and it's for capital offenses. So that when Jesus dies on the cross, Jesus dies the most despicable death. And the death, if we were, we maybe ought to replace the cross in our churches with an electric chair and hang it right up there for everybody to see. We have a very beautiful cross in our church. I mean, it's just magnificent. It really is. Beautiful thing. And maybe even we ought to replace that, maybe even in this state, with a big rope. Because the offense is gone. Moltmann says, you know, Jesus was not crucified on a cross between two candles and some flowers. But you see, that's our image. The scandal, I'm going to get into the scandal of it in a little bit, but right now I just want you to get that image. I want to play with something else, though, which is something that we don't often get into about how Paul came to an understanding, and I think the New Testament and Old Testament comes to an understanding of a theology of the cross. God is a little crazy by our, in fact, he's a lot crazy by our standards. Because when we hear the word God, what do we think of? Power, majesty, this supreme kind of thing. And God, when he identifies, or she, when God comes to this world, and how God works in this world, are not by human standards. Now, Paul learned a lesson, and this is a suggestion from Christer Stendahl, and also from Kaseman. Found Kaseman's commentary just absolutely beautiful at the point of using the theology of the cross to interpret Romans. Now notice in verse 18, he says, for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, in process, not yet finished. Now Paul learned two things from his own life. First of all is that God makes odd choices. If you were going to choose the apostle to the Gentiles, somebody to take God's word to the Gentile world, the Mediterranean basin, what kind of a physical specimen would you choose? You'd have to choose some kind of a hunkin' guy or woman that could go for days on end without sleep, who had it all together physically, right? I mean, that would make sense. He could stay in endless motels and eat McDonald's till it came out his ears and still keep preaching. You'd need a strong physical specimen. The other thing that you would certainly need is somebody who was an eloquent speaker. Somebody who could persuade people by the eloquence of his speech. Turn, if you will, to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. I love this little passage. First of all, we could deal with in 2 Corinthians 12, 9 and following, we could talk about this thorn in the flesh that Paul has, and we're not sure what that is, but at least as a physical specimen, Paul has some kind of a physical affliction, whether that's epilepsy or, as some people suggest from the passage in Galatians where he says, "See with what large letters I'm writing this," that maybe he had a vision problem, but he certainly had some physical problem. Now notice what he says in 2 Corinthians 10:10. We could pick up in 7, but we really, because of time, we'll just pick up this. He's arguing with these people in 1 Corinthians, and he says, "This is what they say about me. They say his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily appearance is weak and his speech of no account." Now, God chooses a strange specimen to be the apostle to the Gentiles. Stranger still, when God recruits the apostle to the Gentile, he recruits the enemy, the church's foremost enemy. That ever occur to you? That what the Damascus Road is about is God choosing the most unlikely candidate to be the apostle to the Gentiles? A fire-eating enemy, a weak specimen, not of eloquent speech by his own admission. Also, we have the story when he's doing the preaching and the guy falls asleep, falls out of the window. Marvelous story, right? I really appreciate that many Sunday mornings. And it took him 2 hours to put him to sleep. But anyway, here's this. Now, that's one strange strand. I want to follow that strand for a moment back to the Old Testament. God makes strange choices. In the cultural mores of the time and place of the First Testament, the firstborn son is the inheritor, the prime inheritor, gets everything, essentially. The first two children born in the Bible in Genesis 4 are who? Cain and Abel. Who is the firstborn? Who is the child of choice? Abel. God chooses, and if you read the text carefully, at the beginning of the text, there is no reason given why God chooses Abel over Cain. Now you can read that out of the text a little bit in terms of the kind of person Cain, but there isn't a word. Maybe Abel was worse than Cain. We don't know why God chooses Abel's offering over Cain's. That ought to be a tip-off that something is going on in this story. When we get to the story of Isaac and his sons, who does God choose, the firstborn or the secondborn? And what kind of a guy is Jacob? He's a shyster of the first order, and God chooses him. Now, when we get into Deuteronomy, and we could look at Deuteronomy 7:7. When Israel is puzzling over its election as people of God, it says, "Why did God choose us? Was it because we were the greatest of the people of the earth? No, we were the least, the fewest in number." Now, the significance of this is that when in those days, a god and the god's country, the god's people, are all woven together, so that when the people lose, the god loses. In fact, I think it's Dan Erlander tells the story about a Navajo tribe down in New Mexico that is out, or maybe it's Arizona, but anyway, it's out in the middle of no place, and they have this Midwestern white clapboard church, and it's Wisconsin Synod. And when Dan first went there, he went there to do to make a slideshow. And when he went there, he asked about, how did you come to be Wisconsin Synod? Well, the thing was that the Navajos had their own religious system, and they were defeated by the
Apache.
Thank you, Daniel.
Have I got the
story right so far, other than that detail? Okay. But so they lose to white people, and so their God has lost, and some Wisconsin Synod missionary walks into town, and so they all convert because the white man's God wins. Is that right, Daniel?
Right.
Okay. That's a picture of what happens when God identifies, and that's their understanding. You don't understand the plagues and the whole Exodus experience unless you understand that one of the things that's going on between Moses and Pharaoh is a fight between the gods, and Yahweh wins. But the interesting thing is that when you read the history of Israel, Israel usually loses. God hooks up with a loser. And in spite of what you read in Sunday school, except during the time of Solomon, when maybe Israel made it into the AAA league, they never amounted to a hill of beans in the history of the world. God makes strange choices. Look at David. Now, we've read the story of David with all the royal theology, which tends to obscure his election. But if you look at when Samuel comes to Jesse's house to choose the new king, Jesse has how many sons? He has eight. So Samuel tells Jesse, I'm coming to choose one of your sons to be king. So Jesse has seven of them there and one of them out tending sheep. And the youngest one out tending sheep. So they parade by like it's some kind of a Mr. Israel contest there, and none of them pass muster. And so Samuel says to Jesse, don't you have one more son? Well, yeah, but he's out tending sheep. That is the one that God chooses. Now, I think we miss the point unless we understand, again, the youngest son. When Solomon follows David, he's not the son of choice normally because he isn't the firstborn. Now, something is going on. And I just want to leave that out. I don't, you know, in one sense I want to lift it up and then I want to leave it. Paul experiences in his own experience that God makes this strange choice. Now, the next strange thing about God is when he chooses you, it is an election to responsibility more than it is an election to privilege. What does God do with the folks he chooses? He gives them up for the sake of the world. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. I mean, it's enough that God makes these strange choices and we ought to think, aha, we're in now. But what we're into is something else. Therefore, having this ministry, this is chapter 4 of 2 Corinthians verse 1 and following. Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart. Well, I should hope not. I mean, after all, God chose us. But why should we lose heart? Well, read on. We have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word, but by the open statement of the truth, we would commend ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled only to those who are perishing. Notice that's a theme again from 1 Corinthians chapter 1. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the likeness of God. Now, what is this glory of Christ, who is the likeness of God? For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For it is the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shown in our hearts to give light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, to show that the transcendent power belongs to God and not to us. Now, when God gets a hold of you, what does he do? We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For while we live, we are always being given up to death, being given up to death, for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be manifest in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. One of the things that you'll notice again, if you go back and look at the folks that God lays his hand on, the prophets, and what do they experience? Acceptance and election to popularity contests? Never. And what about Israel's own history? It is a history of a people who know persecution down to this day. Think of that. I mean, just think of that for a little bit. See G.B. Caird in his commentary on Revelation, when he talks about the continued martyrdom of the saints, makes this very telling comment, that martyrdom, like the cross, is the continued cost of the patience and love of God for the world. God always gives his people up for the sake of the world. Now, those are two strands of thought. God makes strange choices, and when we are chosen to be given up for the sake of the world. And I don't think that we understand the Bible unless we get a hold of that, and I think that's one of the reasons why we don't want to understand the Bible. Now, I'll try to make some conclusions when we get to the end. If you'll turn now, I want to go to another strand. I want to deal with the cross of Jesus. Let's turn to Mark chapter 15. If you read Mark 15 with any care at all, and notice what words are stated over and over again. One of the words that comes over and over again is crucified. I mean, Mark overdoes it with the word crucify. We have the crowd calling out in verses 13 and 14, and they cried out again, "Crucify him!" And then they shouted all the more, "Crucify him!" And then in verse 15, and he delivered him to be crucified. And then in verse 20, and they led him out to crucify him. And in verse 24, they crucified him. In verse 25, when they crucified him. And then in verse 32, those who were crucified with him also reviled him. Mark does not want to have the point missed. They crucified him, right? I mean, even I caught that. How many times did he say that? Now, if crucifixion is such a horrendous thing, why all this emphasis? Hengel has shown that in every culture to which the gospel would have been addressed in its day, crucifixion was unthinkable for a hero and certainly for a god. And that crucifixion belongs in the Roman Empire and in the Roman time to the death of slaves and to the lowest class in the society. That it is an utterly despicable way to die, because they strip you, you hang naked and exposed in the most public view. Read again the Old Testament sometime and notice what a kind of a thing they had about somebody having their nakedness revealed. So that Deuteronomy 21:23 can talk about that a person who hangs from a tree is cursed by whom? By God. Now, this is the death that Jesus dies. Now, I want to leave out a verse in this the passage I'm going to read now, and I want to leave it out for a purpose. I want you to see this as a drama. And the one scene that we're going to leave out would not have been a part of this drama for the persons who were there. It kind of takes place off stage, and that's in verse 38 of chapter 15. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. In other words, the centurion and those who were there would not have seen that happen. I think that's Mark's way of talking about access to God, which is torn from top to bottom. God's doing. But anyway, let me read verse 33 and through 39, and you can just kind of visualize what's going on here in your mind. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabanathaki, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders hearing it said, behold, he is calling Elijah. And one ran and filling a sponge full of vinegar, put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that he thus breathed his last, he said, truly this man was the Son of God. Now I think any way you read that story, you have to say that's very strange. What moved the centurion to say when he sees a man die, condemned as a criminal, dying saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? That he utters a confession of faith like this. What sense do you make of that? How do you understand that? To add to the mystery, the highest title that Mark uses for Jesus Christ is the Son of God. But he only uses it very sparingly. In fact, the first verse of his gospel says, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And then no one ever calls Jesus Son of God again until this passage, except for unclean spirits who come fairly close. They will say, we know who you are, the Holy One of Israel. The heavenly voice says, this is my beloved Son. But no human being calls Jesus by that title till this centurion. What did he see? Why did it move him to say, this was the Son of God? Now you'll notice your footnote says it could be read a Son of God. And that comes because in the Greek the definitive article is missing. But the Greek grammatical structure is such that when you have something that is so definite, I mean, it's so absolutely, there's only one of a kind of a thing, you can leave off the definitive article and have it mean the, underline, Son of God. Does this, I mean, am I just barking up a tree about how strange it is that this should be the fullest revelation of God? Isn't that strange to you? I mean, if God is going to reveal who God is, that the choice is the crucifixion of a human being. See, one of the things in Mark's gospel, the disciples never know who Jesus is. They're what I call gross stupid. And so Jesus is always saying, don't you understand? Don't you understand? And yet Mark has set his gospel up in a way that you can never understand who Jesus is until crucifixion. Now notice how utterly desolate Jesus is in this passage. The closest comfort he has are some women with binoculars. Notice in verse 40 and following. And there were some women from stood afar off. Now I think that scandal is so great that the New Testament cannot live with it itself. So that by the time you get to Luke and John, you begin to get some softening of the radicalness of this. They leave off the word, my God, why have you forsaken me? And in Luke's gospel, Jesus dies as a king. He pardons those that, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. He grants entrance, citizenship into the kingdom to the penitent thief. And in John's gospel, he dies in utter control of things. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. It's so scandalous. We have trouble living with it. Now, the other thing I need to say in defense of Luke, and although he needs not my defense, he's been around longer than I am and will be here when I leave. But one of the interesting things, if you turn now to Luke chapter 24, which is kind of Luke's summary of the whole story, you find again, I think just a very easy literary device is whenever you see an author repeating something, you'd better get onto it that author thinks this is important stuff. So then in chapter 24, verse 26, Jesus is speaking and says, "Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?" And then in beginning in 45, "Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures and said to them, 'Thus it is written, that the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance and forgiveness of sin should be preached,'" and so on. But notice again that it was necessary that the Christ should suffer. Now, the trouble that we have, I think one of the troubles we have at least, is that we always jump from this kind of thing to a theory of atonement. In other words, we try to get at, well, what does this mean? And so in the New Testament itself, there are three theories of atonement. One is that Jesus dies as sacrifice. That's called the Latin theory of atonement. That what Jesus is doing is that he who is the guiltless Lamb of God sacrifices his person for the sake of the rest of us. Then there is also in the New Testament the theme of Christ as the victor, the classical theory of the atonement, that Jesus has overcome in death and resurrection all the enemies of humankind, everything that would hold us in bondage. And so the writer in Colossians can say that in the cross, Jesus made a public spectacle of all of these enemies which would enslave us. He nails them to the cross, making a public spectacle of them. And then there's also what may be called the moral theory of the atonement, which is that when we see the depth of God's love for us in Jesus Christ as he goes to the cross, then our hearts will be drawn to such tremendous love. Now, all three of those are New Testament atonement theories. The problem is that we get so quickly to atonement theories that, like Gerhard Ferdi suggests in Where God Meets Man, is that we forget that the first thing that was going on the cross was that Jesus was dying. And like Klaus Westermann says in his book, What Does the Old Testament Say About God? The important thing is the story. What happened is more important than what we think about what happened. So the first thing is Jesus was dying. And the death he died was an awful death. If Madison Avenue had been around to package the God story, if they had been in the councils, they would have said, "Now let's forget that plan because it will not sell." And those folks are still among us in the church, I believe. And so I think, you know, the church growth thing that teaches that homogeneity and the right location for your church and all kinds of stuff like that playing to the, you know, to the values of the society in order kind of to hook people in and have colored fountains and crystal cathedrals and all of that is contrary to the gospel of Jesus Christ. When Jesus, you know, I've argued with lots of folks about this in my own synod, but, you know, they will tell us that, you know, like in the case of Schuller, who publicly, you know, plays down the awfulness of the crucifixion and the cross is involved, but has a very good ministry inside the congregation, and preachers who do preach more of that, you know, but you have to get them there first. Jesus never played that game. And when he sat down to talk to people about discipleship, he went with them right up front. So that the rich young ruler is given choice and he leaves and it breaks Jesus' heart, but he lets him go. So anyway, that's my little digression on church growth. The other thing that that I want to say about this and get it in, and then we can spend some time visiting. In the resurrection account in Mark 16, we have some difficulty getting at the English, or getting at the Greek in our English. When the young man says in 16:6, "Do not be amazed, you seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen, he is not here. See the place where they laid him." The Greek of he has risen is an aorist. It's a past tense. It has happened. It's completed. But the was crucified is an imperfect tense, so that it means it has taken place in the past, but the significance of that action continues into the future. So that in essence, Jesus continues to be the crucified one. And I think that's very important for us to understand that he continues in his life, in essence, in cruciform. And so that when Matthew, I think, picking up this same kind of theme in Matthew 25, says, "I was hungry, I was thirsty, you ministered to me," that's where we see him. And notice this text goes on to say, "Go and tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him." And then you have to ask yourself in Mark's gospel, what does Jesus do in Galilee? He ministers to the sick, to the hungry, preaches, teaches. That's where we see this crucified and risen Christ. I think we should always put together crucified and risen Lord. Now, if this is the deepest expression of God, that that God identifies with the lowest class of society in his death. If God is shown to be who God is at God's fullest, we have to look to the cross. And what does that say to us? Well, one of the things it says to me, that unless God has canceled John 3:16 and not told us about it, namely that God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, and God still so loves this world, and this world, you know, we treat one another as we do to ourselves what we do, then what must it be like to be God? It must mean that God suffers ultimately to this day. Have you ever had that as an image of God? Now, to go back to the Old Testament, seems to me that one of the things the Old Testament was on to was that this God who chooses this kind of a motley crew is a God then who chooses to suffer with them. The one thing, the one theological tenet the Old and New Testament will never give up is the fact that God is in control. The thing is, this world doesn't look like God is in control. So how does that control operate? It operates in that if the world is going to hell in a handbasket, then God is in the handbasket with us. And that God chooses to be with his people in the midst of their suffering and pain. And for me, one of the great statements of that is in Hosea. So I'd like to have you turn to Hosea 11. John Patterson, in his book entitled The Goodly Fellowship of the Prophets, says that he has this little phrase that I just love, and that is this: God hid a gospel in the heart of Hosea's suffering. Now, in Hosea 11, the first verses of Hosea 11 are an indictment of a rebellious son, an incorrigible child. If you go back to Deuteronomy 21, verse 18 and following, you will find out what the Old Testament says you ought to do with incorrigible children. What you do with incorrigible children is you have them stoned to death. And incidentally, if you're for capital punishment on the basis of the Bible, then I think you've got to be for it on the basis of everything in the Bible, and that's one of them. Incorrigible children should be taken before the elders at the city gate and stoned to death. All right. Well, it sure would. Okay. Now, in this first passage, this first part of Hosea 11, God is bringing through Hosea an indictment of an incorrigible child. And this child, this nation, deserves death. It's just clear as can be. Notice how it begins. When Israel was a child, I loved him. Out of Egypt, I called my son. The more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning incense to idols. And the whole thing is an indictment. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. Rebellion is a response to God's goodness. Then in verse 7, my people are bent on turning away from me, so they are pointed to the yoke and none shall remove it. That's the sentence they deserve. But then notice this passage. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zebulun? My heart recoils within me. My passion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come to destroy. What a picture of the heart of God that suffers. Those of us who have children and who know a little bit about what it means to hurt when your children hurt, what it means to be in agony when you know they're doing things that are harmful and there's not a thing you can do. Begin to understand something of this God who attaches himself to people like us, who chooses to be involved in a world like this. I believe that to be God means to suffer ultimately. Now, some conclusions and some, you know, this is, like I mentioned, a lot of jumping around, but I think, you know, maybe it'll at least provoke some thoughts for you. What it means, first of all, is that God will always be a God of surprises, and that God will probably be working in the places where the world often least expects God to be at work. That ought to do something to our arrogance and our certitude. Who could have imagined the choices that God has made and continues to make? The next thing is that these odd choices are, for me, gospel. If God could choose the kinds of folks he's chosen, then that may mean that he chooses folks like us still today. That's gospel. That's good news. The bad news part of that good news is that choice is probably not choice to Cadillacs and to success. Douglas Hall, in the book, has The Church of Future, has a beautiful section about what happens when we turn the story of Jesus into a success story. Because he says if we do that, what we do is we take Christ out of the experience of every human being. Because finally, every human being is, by the world standard, a failure. None of us get out of it alive. None of us are in the kind of control we think we ought to be or we want to be. We all finally fail. And the beautiful parable of that for our time is Howard Hughes, who dies one of the richest men in the world. And how does he die? An utter failure by every human standard. So if we make Jesus' story a success story, let me give you another illustration of that, what it means to have a God who suffers. When I first got into the parish, I followed Gene Foat at Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Fairfax, Virginia, and I'd been there about a month, and a man by the name of Randall Myers went to the hospital for supposed to be a minor surgery, and they found out he had a malignancy in his testicle. In December, just before Christmas, he was in the Washington Hospital Center for a lymphatic cancer operation. And I went to see him, and I was really working on heavy stuff. I was trying to figure out whether to wear a clerical collar or clerical shorts or whatever. So I was doing a lot of ministry. But one of the things, and I can't remember whether I had a collar on that day or not, but anyway, I went to give him communion before that surgery, and for some reason, which to this day I have no recollection as to how the conversation went this way, and nor do I remember when its significance hit me. That's how I'm a Norwegian, and so it took a while, I'm sure. But we got to talking. He was scared to death, if you pardon the pun. I mean, it was amazing. For some reason, we got to talking about Jesus in Gethsemane and how he did not want to die. How the facing of that was so great that and so remarkable that all of the writers, and Luke finally says that his sweat became as drops of great blood, or great drops of blood. It was agony for Jesus to face his death. That's the Jesus who helped Randall. It was amazing to know that we could pray. And what it means is that for all the people who are God forsaken, to know that in Jesus Christ we have one who is God forsaken with us. It's one of the paradoxes that in God's forsaking us, Jesus does not forsake us. Now, I don't understand what that means, but I think that's what Mark was on to. He was in a church, I'm convinced, that felt that God had deserted them. Remember the story of Jesus in the boat, and they have the storm on the Sea of Galilee at the end of chapter 4 in Mark? Jesus is sacked out in the boat, and they come back there and they say to him, "Lord, don't you care if we perish?" And I think that was the cry of Mark's church. And the answer is, my God, why have you forsaken me? I'm here with you when you cry out like that. And for most of the world, people, that's where it's at. To watch your child starve to death. That's where most of the world lives. And I think we're going to have to learn from them about what these passages mean, because I don't know what they mean. I only know they're there and they're to be dealt with. Now, the other thing that this has to say about discipleship, and I want to be very clear, I think we can turn the theology of the cross into the most awful law in terms of discipleship. Luther supposedly said, you know, don't worry about gathering the wood for your cross. The world will take care of that for you. And I'm sure, you know, one of the reasons that I'm so frightened of taking stands on a lot of things that I know the gospel calls me to is that I know there's wood involved in that. But I also know that the gift in all of that is, you know, I'll bet you that Paul never visited a psychiatrist, you know, wondering who he was and what he was about. In the psychological terms, I think he a lot of times must have wondered what God was about. But his life had meaning and purpose. Now that doesn't mean automatically, and I don't want to say that in any stretch, you know, any sense that's the reason one should follow, and that it will be automatic, or that one won't be in torment. Douglas Hall, in a lecture I heard him give one time, said the interesting thing is that the people who have been most committed to the faith, in terms of following in discipleship, have often wondered the same thing that Jesus wondered, and Paul must have wondered. Has God forsaken us? Have we gone so far that we've lost the faith? You know, to wonder, to address ourselves to God as the psalmist do. Why are you asleep? Why are you so far from helping me? Okay, those are all just some random thoughts to provoke you. The last book I want to underscore and tell you that I think really deals with this whole issue is Silence by Endo, the Japanese Roman Catholic layman. And read that book if you can stand it. And it's just utterly beautiful. But he lays out for us this suffering Christ. Okay, and he says something about who says, and this is one of the provocative questions in Silence, who says that the weak don't suffer as much as the strong? Okay, Chuck?
I remember growing up as a child in confirmation classes, a number of my pastors kept emphasizing the fact that Lutherans had an empty cross because they were resurrection-oriented, and Roman Catholics had a crucifix always on their cross because of the centrality of the crucified Christ. They were wrong and we were right, was the implication. It occurs to me that maybe the reverse was true, that our overemphasis of an empty cross is glorification, victorious kind of theology of glory, and that reading the cross in front of us of a grotesque crucified Christ might be better symbolism for us.
The interesting thing is we always have to have an idol, this God, I think. And I think you even probably talked about that.
Yeah, that's going to be course two on this, introduction to idol making.
That, you know, there's a... We just can't seem to stay on even keels in all of this. So I haven't said anything about resurrection. I think the resurrection must be seen as part of this crucifixion, but it isn't the kind of success that we have termed it to be. Because I think the suggestion is in the biblical materials that the risen Christ is the crucified Christ, and the accounts that deal with particularly in John, the emphasis on the stigmata, see these marks. Whatever the risen Christ is, carries the marks of the cross still.
I liked what you mentioned about the death or the crucifixion. He's a crucified and risen, and that those have to always go together. And when we think of the Western emphasis on the death and the Eastern emphasis on the resurrection, I think this helps us to see that we need both of them. If you stay only on the one, you're missing the other. Now, you can't have the life without the death. All of nature teaches us this. And so there is the two things, crucifixion, death, but then resurrection and life. And you need them both.
And the church, if you read Kaiserman's book, Jesus Means Freedom, you'll see, in terms of his understanding of what's going on in the Corinthian correspondence is they jumped over on the resurrection side of things and had the death of Jesus totally behind them. And so it didn't matter what they did. I mean, so there is that correction. It seems to me that we have lived in a success-oriented culture so long that this Jesus is the one we have most trouble understanding and having.
Is that because we want things to be resolved? Right. We want things to be intentional. We want things to be resolved. And the resolution comes in the light and the resurrection and the success and that sort of thing. We don't want the tension. You already mentioned it. The freedom and responsibility are tied together. You can't have one without the other. A horse and carriage, love and marriage. We want to have one part without the other. We forget the tension.
And we've often sold Christianity as offering success. I remember when I was still in college, and I grew up in a very pietistic congregation that was. We had one guy who almost quit the Lutheran Herald because it did have on the cover one time a crucifix, and that just about did him in. And so I grew up with a very much a theology of glory. But I was coming back from, I lived over here in Eastern Washington, I was driving from Richland back to my home, and there was a radio evangelist on talking about how in Hong Kong there was a missionary there that as the Chinese fishermen were converted, they noticed that the Christians were catching more fish than the non-Christians. And at that point I turned it off. Not even, I think the Luther's strand of a theology of the cross was so deeply embedded that even our congregation couldn't finally eradicate it. That somehow that's not the point. You know, you get into all kinds of interesting things. When I first got to Renton, there were a lot of people who were into the praying for parking spaces routine. And you know, when you take prayer seriously, at what point does it, you know, what point does God bless or not bless? And, you know, you get into all kinds of problems. But anyway, it's something for us all to puzzle with.
What was the, Bowen cut back an illustration of the danger of irresponsible praying?
Could be.
I'd like to go back to what you were commenting on with the Mark 15 section and the centurion's response to seeing Christ on the cross. Somehow I didn't quite understand or wanted some clarification on what you were asking the question, why?
Christ beats me. But let me say something I think about Mark's agenda. I think Mark is saying, first of all, we never understand Jesus until we've seen the cross. I think that's his theological statement. Now, the mystery comes in understanding and seeing that at the depth of the death of a person killed as a common criminal. Now, whether he got railroaded or not, that's another question. You see, and I think even the fact that Jesus got railroaded adds to the meaninglessness and the senselessness of that death. It did not have to happen. But how many deaths is that not also true of in our world? Senseless killings. And so this is a senseless death. You know, whether carried out by injustice or whatever. And so the centurion, who does not have, we can assume, the religious tradition of Judaism to help, although that's not a help either, because cursed be anybody who hangs on a tree. So it's just a profound mystery that the fullest expression of who God is seen in the death of a human being on a cross. That is the mystery.